Well, good morning. It's great to see everyone. If you would like a translation of the service, please just use the QR code that will be shown on the screen in a moment, and that will take you through to a website where you'll be able to access one. And if you haven't got a Bible yet and you would like one, please do put up your hand and one will be brought to you. And if you're using a church Bible, one of the blue Bibles, we are back on page 62. We are looking at page 62. And the book of Exodus, we are back in our series in Exodus, and we're looking at chapter 21 and verses 1 to 11. And we've got one summer search prize this morning, and that is for Joshua. Now, in the ancient world, when a king conquered a nation and subjected that nation to him, he would make a binding agreement with them, a covenant. And in that covenant, the nature of his relationship with them would be set out so that they understood who he was and who they were. He was their king and they were his conquered people. And then the covenant would go on to explain the different laws that their new king wanted them to keep. And as we return to our series in the book of Exodus, and we're going to be looking at chapters 21 to 24 over the next few weeks, we need to have that concept in our minds, the concept of a king making a binding agreement, a covenant with a nation, and giving them his law to live by. Now, God has saved the nation of Israel from Egypt. He has defeated Pharaoh, and he has forced Pharaoh to let Israel go. Having brought Israel out of Egypt and through the Red Sea, he has then led them safely through the wilderness to Mount Sinai, chapter 19, where they are told that their king will appear and give them his covenant and his law. The people are given time to prepare themselves. And then on the third day, God, their king, arrives. And it's very dramatic. There is thunder and lightning and thick cloud and the sound of a trumpet blast. And the whole mountain shook violently and was covered with fire and smoke. And the people also shook and quaked as God, their king, came down and descended on the mountain and revealed himself in his holiness and his awesome majesty. He then set out for them in chapter 20 and verse 2, the nature of their relationship with him. He is the Lord their God who has saved them from Egypt and rescued them from slavery. So that's their relationship with him. He is the Lord their God and they are his rescued people. Having outlined the nature of their relationship with him, from chapter 20 verse 3 to verse 21, he then gave them 10 laws that he wanted them to live by. What are they? Well, God tells them, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make any carved images. You shall not take my name in vain. You shall keep the Sabbath day holy. You shall honor your parents. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not tell lies. You shall not covet. These are the 10 laws that God wanted them to keep. 10 laws which are summed up in those two great commandments. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. And you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And then from chapter 20, verse 22, to the end of chapter 23, God gives to them the book of the covenant. The book of the covenant. So if you were to look at page 65... look at chapter 24 and verse 7. You will see that description being used, the book of the covenant. So you have the Ten Commandments and you have the book of the covenant. Now, the Ten Commandments are linked to the book of the covenant, but they are also distinct from the book of the covenant. And we see that in different ways. So, for example, God gave the Ten Commandments directly to the people. They heard his voice from the mountain. But he gave the book of the covenant to the people through Moses. God himself wrote down the Ten Commandments on those tablets of stone. But Moses wrote down the book of the covenant, presumably on parchment. The words that are used to refer to the Ten Commandments and the Book of the Covenant are different. So the Ten Commandments are linked to the Book of the Covenant, but they are distinct from it. And so you ask, well, what is the Book of the Covenant? Well, the Book of the Covenant was given by God to the nation of Israel to show them how they were to put the Ten Commandments into practice. The Book of the Covenant contains a mixture of case laws and everyday scenarios and commands, and it was given by God to the nation of Israel to show them how the Ten Commandments were to be kept in their everyday life. So, for example, in the Ten Commandments, the sixth commandment is "you shall not murder," which seems clear enough. However, what do you do if one of your animals, your ox, gores someone and kills them? What happens then? Is it seen as being a tragic accident? Or are you, the owner of the ox, liable for that person's death? And that comes under the sixth commandment. That's not so straightforward, is it? Well, the Book of the Covenant gives you the answer to that dilemma. The Book of the Covenant was given by God to help ethnic Israel put the Ten Commandments into practice. Let me give you a kind of a very simple outline. If we can have the next slide, that'd be really helpful. So chapter 20, verses 22 to 26, you have instructions regarding worship. And we touched on that when we looked at Exodus last time. Then chapter 21, verse 1 to chapter 23 and verse 19, you have a variety of everyday scenarios and case laws and commands. Then in chapter 23, verse 20 to 33, God makes some promises to Israel. And then in chapter 24, you have the covenant ceremony where Israel promised to keep the covenant. Now you might be saying, well, what has this got to do with us? This is the old covenant given to the physical nation of Israel in a certain point of time in history. We are not part of the physical nation of Israel. We live in the UK. And we are not under the old covenant. Jesus has fulfilled the old covenant. We live in a new era within God's salvation plan, and we are under the new covenant which has been put in place at the cross. Well, people have often understood that the old covenant has three categories of law. Let's see if this works. There we go. So you have moral law, and you have civil law, and you have ceremonial law. Now, it's not quite as clear-cut as that, and the Bible itself never explicitly gives those different distinctions, but it's helpful to have those three types of law in mind. The moral law is God's universal standard of righteousness, like, for example, the laws that we see in the Ten Commandments. And of course, as we come to the New Testament and we have the teaching of Jesus and the New Testament, we are shown how the moral law continues today, and it's taught at an even deeper level than it was under the old covenant. And as we go through the Book of the Covenant, we will be reminded of that. The civil law was the nations of Israel's legal system and social system, and much of the Book of the Covenant covers Israel's civil law at this time. And though we live in the UK and we are not under the civil law of Israel at that time, we can still learn from the principles that were behind it. And then, of course, you have the ceremonial law, which consisted of the sacrifices and the symbols related to Israel's old covenantal worship. And though this has been fulfilled in Jesus, it still blesses us as it points us to him and reminds us of our salvation. Now, we're going to begin this new part of our series in Exodus by looking at chapter 21 and verses 1 to 11. And some of these commands and these case laws and these everyday scenarios relating to how the Israelites were to relate to one another. And you will see that we're starting with the topic of slavery. And you ask, why has God put the topic of slavery at the top of these case laws and commands? And The answer is, I don't know. We're not told. I suspect it's partly because Israel themselves had so recently been slaves, and God is telling them that they need to treat their slaves very differently to how they were treated. And they need to treat their slaves very differently to how the pagan nations were treating their slaves. Israel was to be a light to the Gentiles. I also suspect it's because God is showing his heart for the most vulnerable in society. Now, in giving these laws regarding the treatment of slaves, God is not promoting slavery. Rather, he is regulating it and he is curbing it, as he does with other things in the Bible, like divorce. He is working within the mess and the hard-heartedness of sinful humanity. It's also important to understand that when it's talking about slavery here, it's describing something very different to the transatlantic slave trade and all of its evil practices. So in listening to a sermon on this passage, the person preaching gave six very helpful differences between the slavery described here and the transatlantic slave trade, and I'll pass them on to you. Firstly, the slaves here have not been forced into slavery against their will. You can see that in verse 16. They've not been stolen, they've not been kidnapped. They are willing slaves. They are willing slaves. Secondly, you can see that their slavery was time limited. See that in verse 2. Thirdly, this is not ethnic slavery, verse 2. These are Hebrew slaves. And fourthly, mistreatment of slaves was forbidden. You can see that in verses 26 and 27. Indeed, masters should be so kind to slaves that slaves would seriously consider staying with their master and continuing to serve them for the rest of their lives, verses 5 and 6. Fifthly, if a slave ran away from their master, presumably because the master was cruel, and they sought refuge with you, you were to welcome them, protect them, and not hand them back over to their master. And you'll find that in Deuteronomy 23 and verse 15. And then sixthly, when the slave had finished their period of service, you were not to send them away empty-handed. You were to give them such a generous leaving present that they had enough resources to start a new life. And you'll find that in Deuteronomy 15 and verse 13. So when it's talking about slavery in this passage, it's describing something very different to the transatlantic slave trade. Now, the passage divides into two halves, and we're going to look firstly at verses 1 to 6 and male slaves. Verses 1 to 6, male slaves. Why did Israel have slaves? Well, slavery in Israel was designed to help people who had got themselves into so much debt that they couldn't get themselves out of it. So if someone who was in debt had exhausted all other options, their last resort was that they could sell themselves into slavery and use the money that their new master had given to them to clear their debts. Now, in some ways, using the word slave is unhelpful to us because of the connotations that it has in our minds. In Leviticus 25 and verse 40, it describes these slaves as hired servants. And that's a phrase that probably best captures for us what they are. They are hired servants. Yes, they've lost some of their rights for a period of time, but they're not quite slaves in the way that we think of slaves. In fact, some people think that verses 1 to 11 here are connected to the fifth commandment and to family life. For these hired workers were to become part of the family. Reflecting the Sabbath principle of 6 days of work and on the seventh day rest, after 6 years of service, verse 2, their obligations to their master came to an end and they were free to go. They could just walk out of the door. They didn't have to pay anything to be released. They didn't have to be redeemed. They could just go. In fact, as already mentioned, in leaving, their master had to give them a very generous present from his flocks and his harvests and his wine collection. And so I want you to picture this person who has come to the end of his 6 years of service, and they're just about to walk out the door. Once they had debts which they just could not pay, but now all their debts are gone, and their arms are full of so many presents and blessings that they almost can't carry them. And you say, what a tiny but beautiful picture of the gospel that is. If you are a Christian, you once had debts which you could not pay. You once had a mountain of debts which you could not clear. But now, spiritually, you are debt-free. All your debts have been taken away, and you have been given every spiritual blessing that is found in the heavenly places. And of course, it's even more wonderful for you, because it's not you who's worked off the debts. It's Jesus who has paid them off for you. So this slave is now in a situation where his debts have been cleared. He's learned new skills from his master. He's been given lots of resources, meaning that he can start a new life providing for himself. If he entered into slavery single, he left single, verse 3. If he entered into slavery married, he left with his wife. If, however, he entered into slavery single and his master had given him a wife, verse 4, when he left, his wife and his children had to stay with the master. Now, at first, that just sounds really harsh. But of course, as we know, whenever we read something in the Bible which doesn't seem to show God in a good light, it's not because God is not good, it's because we don't understand what's going on. Remember, this man had previously managed to get himself into so much debt that his last resort was to sell himself into slavery. However, he should now be in a position where he can be a productive member of society and over time can buy his family's freedom. If he can't purchase his family's freedom, maybe because he's useless with money and that's why he got himself into debt in the first place, or he's so selfish and he's always spending his money on himself, then his family will continue to be cared for and provided for by the master. And it was a way of continuing to care for these vulnerable people. Now, of course, there was another option open to the slave, verses 5 and 6. If the slave plainly says, so they're saying this willingly without any pressure from their master, if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife and my children, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him to God. And it's thought that the bringing him to God there probably means bringing him before judges so that the judges and the witnesses could ensure that he's not being forced into what he's offering to do. His master shall bring him to God, and he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl, that's a metal tool, and he shall be his slave forever. So masters were to be so fair and so kind that this was a genuine option for slaves. And for some of them, they would be willing to serve their master forever. And they would be willing to bear the master's mark on their body, showing that they were his devoted servant. Slavery in Israel was to be very different to the slavery in the pagan nations. Israel was to be a light to the Gentiles. So that's male slavery. Then we come on to verses 7 to 11 and female slavery. And you say, what is going on here? it seems that female servants are being treated differently to male servants. Male servants were allowed to leave after 6 years of service, but in verse 7, it says that female servants were not allowed to leave after 6 years. And you say, well, what's going on? Well, I think that the situation in verses 7 to 11 is a different situation to verses 1 to 6. It's not that God loves his daughters less. It's just a different scenario. It's a different form of slavery. In verses 7 to 11, a father is pledging his daughter to someone in marriage in exchange for money. It could be marriage to the master, or verse 9, it could be marriage to the master's son. In their society, fathers who were very poor would sometimes arrange marriages for their daughters to those who were wealthier than them in this way, and it was a means of ensuring that their daughters were lifted up out of poverty and were provided for. You notice in verse 9 that the female slave was not to be thought of as a slave, but as a valued member of the family with full family rights. If she was pledged to the master's son, the master was to view her as his own daughter. So this is why after 6 years, the female servants weren't free to go. It was because it was a different situation. It was an arranged marriage. Now what happens, verse 8, if the master, her husband, finds that he doesn't like her personality or whatever, or they don't get on? Well, that doesn't give him the excuse to mistreat her or abuse her. That is never acceptable. And he's not allowed to sell her to a pagan nation where she would almost certainly be abused or mistreated. No, he is to let her family buy her back. He is to let her family redeem her. And you notice, verse 8, whose fault it is if he doesn't enjoy the relationship and the marriage is brought to an end. It's his fault. He's the one in the position of power, and he is the one who has broken faith. What about another situation? What if the master were to go and marry another wife? So now he's got two wives, verse 10. Well, if he does that, in that situation, if he neglects his wife, if he stops giving her food or clothing or the opportunity to have children, then she is free to leave without being redeemed. Her husband has neglected her, and the marriage has been broken. Now you say, why on earth is God making provision in situations that are a far cry from what they should be? Well, it's not because God agrees with what's going on. It's not because God likes what is going on. It's not because God likes polygamous marriages and things like that. It's because God is working within the mess and the hard-heartedness of sinful humanity, and he's regulating it and he's curbing it to ensure that vulnerable people are protected and provided for. And I want us to apply this passage as we come to an end in four ways. Firstly, as God works within the mess and the muck of sinful humanity, see God's compassionate heart and kindness for the most vulnerable. As God works within the mess and the muck of sinful humanity, see God's compassionate heart and kindness for the most vulnerable. See how God cares for them. See how God protects them. See how God hates it when people are mistreated and abused. And see how we are to be concerned for and to be praying for and to be caring for and protecting the vulnerable where we can in society. So, for example, slavery is not a thing of the past. Slavery and human trafficking in different forms are still alive today. And that should concern us. And we should be caring for the most vulnerable. Secondly, and I know that it's not exactly the same thing, but if you employ others, if you manage others, if you oversee others, remember that you too have a master in heaven. Now, when Paul addressed the masters of slaves in Colossians 4, I wonder whether he was drawing on passages like this. If you employ people, are you a good boss? Are you a fair manager? Do you oversee people in a kind way? Would they be willing to work for you for a long period of time, or can they not wait to find a new job and be free from you because of how you treat them and because they fear you? Thirdly, see the gospel. See the gospel. You think of that slave in verses 5 and 6 who comes to the end of his period of service, and yet he willingly has that metal tool pushed through his ear and into the door or the doorpost. What does that remind you of? What would that have reminded these people of? Well, that would have reminded these people of another time when blood ran down a doorpost. It would have reminded them of the Passover lambs in Egypt and how through the blood of the Passover lamb on the doorpost, they were saved from God's judgment. It reminds us, of course, of the Passover lamb who was pierced for us. Jesus is the ultimate servant, isn't he? He is the suffering servant. He is the King of heaven who has humbled himself. And he has come not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Christian, isn't it so amazing that Jesus has served you? Isn't it so amazing that Jesus has served you? That Jesus has willingly taken your debt upon himself and cleared it for you. And if you're not a Christian here this morning, did you know that Jesus can serve you in this way, and he's willing to serve you in this way? He is willing to serve you by taking away your sin as far as the east is from the west. Go to him this morning and ask him to be your servant as well as your king, and to serve you by taking away your sin. He's willing to do that for you. And then fourthly, if you are a Christian, remember that you too are a servant. If you are a Christian, remember that you too are a servant. Who are you a servant of? You are a servant of the Lord Jesus Christ. That's who you serve. In fact, think of how Paul often described himself. He described himself as a bondslave, a slave. What does Paul have in mind there? He has verses 5 and 6 in mind there. That's the picture he's using. He's describing himself as someone who freely and willingly is devoting themselves to be a slave of Jesus forever. I willingly and freely choose to be a slave of Jesus forever. And is that how you see yourself this morning? You are not your own anymore. You have been bought with a price. You belong to the Lord Jesus Christ. And we have the privilege of willingly and freely devoting ourselves and being a slave to Jesus. And he is the best master in the world. He is the best master in the world, and there should be nothing that is too hard for us to do or to give to him. And let's just take a moment to pause and reflect. And then we're going to sing of Jesus the King who came to serve.